Once upon a time, there was a lovely young couple, and this is a fable which is meant to resemble no one in particular in this congregation or any congregation that I know. But there was a lovely young couple, and their names were Tom and Margaret, which to prove to you that I'm not thinking of anyone, I've tried to pick two names that I don't think are in this room today. If your name is Tom or Margaret, I'm not talking about you. Tom and Margaret had three children. They had two cars. They had a nice home, and they had a fighting problem. Margaret loved to run to the mall for a cute skirt, to die for her handbag. She always had the latest do. Her hair was very lovely. When she was stressed, she liked to get manicures, and sometimes, in an inexplicable fashion to Tom, she would actually pay someone to touch her feet, something he spent all his days trying not to ever let anyone do. And she would come home excited about her purchases that made her feel so good, and she would say, "Oh, honey, don't you love this jacket? Isn't it so cute?" Tom would usually only say something derogatory like this: "Ugh, I wonder how many hours I'm going to have to put in to fund this latest excursion of yours." And then they would start a love quarrel. He would begin to accuse her: "You're so reckless and vain. You're going to get us in trouble. All you do is spin, 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 spin. You just want to look good for other people. You're so careless with money." Margaret would be deeply hurt. But that hurt would usually turn into a biting sort of anger. And she would look at him and say, "Well, you're just a miser, Tom. Money was given to us to be enjoyed. And all you care about is your precious brokerage account statement. You're such a tightwad. That's why nobody likes you. You're stingy." And then, feeling smug and self-satisfied, they would each go to opposite corners of the house, because the kids were not there when they had that fight. And they would, because they were Christians, they would, as they began to cool off, they would pray a little bit. And each, convinced that God was on their side, would begin to pray like the Psalms to God: "God, help her to see how reckless she is. What a spendthrift she is. Help her to see how you made us to be good stewards of our money." And she would weepingly cry out, "Oh God, please do something about his selfish heart. He loves money so much." And because they were not Presbyterian but Charismatics, this particular day, as they were praying, the Lord spoke a word to them. It was audibly, so that both of them in the house could hear it at the same time. Jesus, in audible fashion, took up the words of Ice-T, who said, "Guys, you better both check yourself before you wreck yourself." They were a little stunned. What does he mean? But he wouldn't answer their complaints. But he said something like this: "Be on your guard against all kinds of greed." And I see two different kinds right now. In our passage today, Jesus is using the earnest and concerned plea of a man who's in a battle over an inheritance as a teaching occasion. And as Jesus says something essentially the same to this guy that he said to Tom and Margaret in our fable that is based on no one in particular, Jesus gives some pretty fierce words. This man says, "Tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me." This man, presumably assuming he's all right and his brother's all wrong, because that's how all kinds of things like this are. And so he's asking Jesus to come in and mediate. "Set my brother straight. Make him give me what I deserve. Jesus, unlike Judge Judy and the 4,000 other daytime arbitrators, Nancy Grace and all the other angry, strange people who try to settle disputes, Jesus did not ask for the facts of the case, for no dingy photos of the apartment. Jesus said, "Hey, you saying that reminds me of the story of a fool." I'm like, dang, Jesus, that's kind of mean. And this story gives us one of the kinds of examples of Jesus doing this sort of thing that should make you suspicious whenever you hear anybody talking about how Jesus is just so tender and mild, so gushy and sweet. Anybody who says that, who doesn't think Jesus has some pretty fierce things and pretty meddlesome things to say about our lives, hasn't read the Gospels. But when you hear these fierce things, you need to hear them much like you'd hear and watch a parent speaking to a child when you say, "You better get down for supper, or there'll be no more wee time. You need to come home by curfew or you'll be grounded." Or an employer saying to a perpetually tardy employee, "If you continue to show up 3 hours late, I'll have no choice but to fire you." Assuming the goodwill of the one making the threat, all threats in those cases are not done because the threater hopes to make the threat come true. It's just the opposite. They say harsh things, they say threatening things in hopes that it will make the person being threatened look at themselves, look at their practices, look at what they're doing, and say, "Oh my goodness, I didn't realize it. I need to change." When Jesus speaks about this rich fool, that God says, "Your very life is going to be demanded from you tonight," these judgment sorts of words, he's saying them so that they won't come true for you, or for this man in the crowd, or for Tom and Margaret, should they exist. Jesus is letting us in on something as he says, "Watch out, be on your guard against all kinds of greed." He's letting us know that this is the kind of money sickness that comes over people that they're very, very blind to. But they're very aware of it in other people. I had the opportunity recently to hear Tim Keller give a talk where he said, "Money is rarely ever our idol, it just reveals what our idols are. The way we spend it or save it, it just reveals something about what we're looking to money to do. And all of us are looking for it to do a little something different. And that's why it's so insidious, this sin of greed, because it's really clear when we see it in other people out there, but none of us ever thinks that we are it or that we have it. Tom was sure that Margaret was all wrong because she spends and spends like crazy. Margaret was sure that Tom's all wrong because he hoards and hoards like crazy. Well, C.S. Lewis has said in one place, and I know you've heard me say this before, but if you can get this concept in your head, it will be applicable in all kinds of areas of your life when you start noticing the enemy out there. As he says this, "The devil always sends error in pairs of polar opposites." He always sends error in pairs of polar opposites. So that what happens is over here on the right side, my right, your left, a person sees an error over here on the left, way down across the hall. And it's so clear to them. It's so evident to them. And they're so disgusted by it that they back into an error that they don't even realize they're backing into. While over here on the left side, my left, your right, people are looking down the corridor, and it's so clear to them how wrong they are, while this person backs into their own error. And in the case of Tom and Margaret, you see what Jesus is saying when he says, "Watch out, be on your guard against all kinds of greed," because greed is an internal sickness that presents itself in very different ways in people's lives. Tom has rightly identified that Margaret is looking to money to provide her with a sense that she is something. Money gets her things that make her look pretty, that make people think highly of her. It gives her a momentary thrill. It gives her an identity, what it can purchase her. And he's rightly identified that as a problem. But what he has failed to realize is that all the while he's backing into this error of his own. It looks so different from Margaret's, but his error is that he's looking to his money to give him great comfort and security. He's spending all his relational capital to make sure that if anything happens, he's got it covered. Margaret over here can see so easily how Tom has got a hoarding problem. He loves money because of the security it brings, but she has no idea that she loves money just as much. She just doesn't want the security that it brings. She wants the acceptance that it brings. It makes her look like the right people. It makes her find approval in the right settings. And so both of them have no idea about their own error, and they're both convinced about the error of the other. Jesus says, watch out. These kinds of errors come over us. This kind of greed eats us up. And we see it in other people, but we never have any idea about ourselves until it's too late. And one of the tests, and some of the stuff I realize that I have said before, I don't know if you remember though, and so I'm going to say it again, I've found a good diagnostic tool to figure out, and I tell people this in premarital counseling, a good diagnostic tool to figure out which bent you're on, which inclination that you have. A little hypothetical situation, say you leave here today, and you're on your way out, and you get a call, let's say it's from your grandma. And grandma says to you, honey, I'd like to give you $100. Okay, I could make it more. Well, it's an example. I'd like to give you $100. I understand that you need some new shoes. And they're $100, and I'd like to give you some money to get those shoes, okay? Now, here's my question to you. What do you do if you're talking to grandma? Now, some of you in here, in talking to grandma, would hear that. You'd run to the mailbox the next day. You'd get that check. You'd burn rubber to the bank to cash it. The thing would be burning a hole in your pockets. They'd be on fire. You'd have those new shoes in 27 minutes. Yes! New shoes! It could be any amount of money and any kind of thing. You understand it's an example. But some of you, you're listening to grandma, and you know to be polite, your mama taught you to say thank you. You said, thank you, grandma, I appreciate your generosity. That's so sweet of you to think of me. And inside you're going, I ain't getting no shoes. I'm banking it. I'd much rather have $100 in the bank than I'd rather have a pair of shoes. Who needs a pair of shoes? I've got a pair of shoes. And if you look at your tendency, you can kind of realize where you might tend to land. Some of you just want to make sure there's money in the bank. You're willing to go without all sorts of things just so you know there's money in the bank. Some of you don't care about there being money in the bank. You just want the things, the approval, the acceptance, the whatever that the things can get you. You both got a problem. We've all got a problem with this. And it's helpful to start to look at it. Keller said, you know, I find that when it comes to giving, I give, but not always with a great deal of ease. But when I go into a bookstore, I find that I can spend money on a book without thinking about it. The newer, the more hardback, the more expensive, the better. I have no trouble buying books. I don't even think about buying books. I just buy them. But I have to think about whether I give my money away. And he says, well, you know, but there's no real temptation to me to go buy clothes. Clothes don't really do it for me. I buy books because that's my identity. I'm an authority. I'm somebody who knows stuff. People look to me to know about things, and books are how I learn. That's how I see myself. That's how I have an identity. But some of you, Like, why on earth would you buy a book when there's so many cute skirts out there? Or, why on earth would you buy a cute skirt when there's so many cool four-wheelers out there? Why on earth would you spend money on a four-wheeler when there's so many cool places to visit? Why on earth would you visit so many cool places when you can invest in your children so that they would become great extensions of your fame? What? And every one of us, in the ways that we find ourselves easily spending money, easily justifying the spending of money, find that the money itself isn't often the idol. It reveals what it is that's most precious to us, what we value more than anything. And so Jesus would say, watch out for greed in all its forms, because a man's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions. See, because anything that you're looking for money to do, any kind of identity you're looking for it to form, for you, to make you seem like you're something, to live in the right kind of house, to go to the right kind of schools, to be in the right kind of clubs, it's all a way of saying to the money, you make my life. You're what makes me something. If I have you, then I am something. If I don't have you, I'm nothing. And Jesus is saying, your life doesn't consist of this. That's the error of greed, is it's saying to money and what it can purchase, you're my precious. You make me something. And so he tells them this parable. The ground of a certain man, rich man, produced a good crop, and he said to himself, oh my gosh, what am I going to do? I have no place to store my crops. And there is your first signal of something wrong. But it's interesting about how greed works in us. What is the proper response to God's bountiful goodness in your life? If you find that it is anxiety, you've got a problem. Why shouldn't this guy be saying, hallelujah, praise God, look at this crop. I went to bed each night and stuff still grew. I went in sometimes because I was tired and the sun still shone. I never once made it rain. But none of that crossed his mind. All the provision became an emergency. Oh my gosh! All the provision became not a source of gratitude, but a source of anxiety. What am I going to do? It's just like the psychiatrist who said to the man one time, who was very wealthy, what are you going to do with all this money? And he said, I don't know, worry about it, I guess. And he said, well, then why don't you give some of it away? And he said, well, it's a lot easier to worry about it than to deal with the terror that comes to me when I think about giving it away. Unless we be too hard on this fellow, some of you are college students in here, and you'll move into your first apartment after college, and you'll be able to carry all your possessions in your 1986 Subaru GL10 Turbo. Wait, no, that's me. You'll be able to carry all the stuff you own in your car. Right? But here's what will happen by accident. You'll get married, you'll have some kids, you'll get a job, da-da-da-da-da-da-da, and all of a sudden, your stuff won't fit in a Subaru anymore. You'll need 6 trucks. And you'll start saying, oh my gosh, I have so many clothes, I need some more closets. Oh my gosh, we have so much stuff, I need a bigger garage. Oh my gosh, we have so much stuff, I don't know what I'm going to do about it. We need a bigger house. And all the abundance in your life will create anxiety and not gratitude. That's a sign of the money sickness. That's a symptom. So this guy says, what am I going to do? I've got so much. And then he said, this is what I'll do. He's talking to himself. I will tear down my barns and I'll build bigger ones. And I'll store all my grain and all my goods. And I'll say to myself, you see, I'm not just making it up. He's talking to himself and he's envisioning talking to himself. I'll say to myself, self, you have plenty of, he didn't say that. You have plenty of good things laid up for many years. Take life easy. Eat, drink, and be merry. You know what occurs to me when I read this story as I think, wow, this fellow who has been visited with great abundance, is asking all the questions by himself and of himself. He's asking all the questions about his possessions. What do they mean? What am I to do with them? All of the questions he's asking of himself and by himself, which means he's leaving out two gigantic pieces of the puzzle that matter to someone else, with a big S. He's leaving out God, and he's leaving out his neighbor. It hasn't crossed his mind to say, wow, God, why have you given me this surplus? Have you given me this surplus so I might be the most obese man in the land? Have you given me this surplus that I might have the greatest tan on the golf course? Have you given me this surplus so that I can watch movies all day long? Thank you. I hope so. He hasn't even thought to ask God what the surplus means. He hasn't even thought to consider that some of it might be for his neighbors. He hasn't thought to ask his neighbors, hey, what do you think I should do with all this? I've got a huge bumper crop this year. What do you think I should do? What should we do about this? He hasn't thought about God. He hasn't thought about his neighbor. He's fully asking all the questions by himself and of himself. See, when he does this, he shows us something else about the money sickness that takes over us, another symptom of it. You see, what happens is, quickly, as money concerns come over us, and we all have them. We all have money concerns. You can never escape it. Is that as soon as they come on you, money starts dictating all the things about you. And you forget about God, and you forget about your neighbor. It kind of leads you by the nose to forget about those things. And you start asking questions like, when it comes time to get a new house. The question is, how much house can I afford? It's not, God, do you want me to have a new house? Would you provide us with a house that's fitting for us? We start to ask questions when we think God, my car can't be held together anymore by the duct tape that's deteriorating on it. I need a new car. We ask, how much car can I afford? That determines what kind of car I get. What kind of vacation can I afford? That determines what kind of vacation I take. What kind of schooling can I afford? That determines what kind of schooling I get. And we don't think to ask the question, what God might you have for us? If you want us to have a new house, maybe would you provide us a house? If you want me to have a car, would you provide me with a car? Would you direct me in my steps? Help me to know about education, about the things that I need? You know the things I need. Are any of the things that I have for someone else? And I've gotten it all wrong thinking that they're all for me and mine. See, you should be aware of the money sickness anytime all your financial questions are something that you just deal with in your own head. You don't invite anybody else in on them, and you certainly don't invite God in on them. You invite a lot of anxiety that way. Jesus says, here's an antidote for that, by extension. He says, God said to the man, you fool, this very night your life will be demanded from you. Then who's going to get what you've prepared for yourself? This is how it will be for anyone who stores up things for himself but is not rich toward God. One of the problems, I just read Ecclesiastes not long ago, and one of the problems that the teacher in Ecclesiastes recognizes and calls meaningless is this phenomenon that a dude or a dudette can work their fingers to the bone and accumulate great fortunes and then get hit by a Mack truck, or the 8th century BC equivalent of a Mack truck, or whatever century it was. Scott, you can correct me later. Well, and he kind of ponders this. You can work and save and amass and amass and amass, and then some idiot is going to get all your stuff and ruin their life with it and blow right through it and destroy your family tree. Okay, that's cynical. But that is what happens sometimes. And so, God says to this guy, you're a fool. And it's interesting, he's calling a man a fool that we would call very prudent and wise. The man saved up well for his retirement. He's set, so he thinks. And God's saying, you're set. You think you're set because you're living in a dream world. Oh, but all good businessmen know, no, that's not a dream world. The world that God inhabits and controls and engineers and superintends. The world where each one of us wakes up each morning with breath that we did not purchase and we do not have terms on. With heartbeats that are generating blood throughout our whole bodies all day long that we did not pay for. God realizes the most real world is the world that is God's economy, where He's running things, where He's distributing things, where He loves love. And He knows that anytime we move out of service and into selfishness, we destroy ourselves. But see, we're quick. We live in a very economically advanced culture, a very technologically advanced culture, a very medically and politically advanced culture, and it becomes very easy to be practically atheistic, to live as if God does not exist. And all of a sudden we forget. We forget that God has anything to do with anything, especially not our economic life. And so God says, you're a fool, because you've lived as if this life was all you had, and as if all your resources were just for you. You neglected God. And you neglected your neighbor. That was a very foolish thing to do. So, what's the antidote to making that foolish mistake? It's to be rich toward God and neighbor. And how do you be rich toward God and neighbor? Well, one way you do it is in the giving of gratitude. The Apostle Paul, when he talks about riches in 1 Timothy 6, says that godliness with contentment is great gain. There's this sense for all of us that if we are unable to recognize the magnificent deposits that God's put in our lives as His deposits, then all we're going to do is be anxious and fearful. We'll start to think that we bear responsibilities that we don't bear. And so, some of us need to practice a discipline of not letting good things go by unnoticed. It might have to be mechanical. You know what I did the other day when I was in my prayer time? Like a small child, I thought, I'm going to work myself through the alphabet, and I'm going to praise God for something for each letter of the alphabet. You know why? Because I'm a praise Neanderthal. I don't know nothing about praise, so I've got to figure out some way to help myself notice things. Hey, I praise you for Ander. That's my boy. I work my way through the list and I call to mind all the extravagances that God has put in my life. It has the effect of chasing anxieties away. It has the effect of reminding me, wow, I really do live on a planet that I am not controlling. Because I'm sorry to say that I, like a lot of you, think I am controlling it sometimes. So the giving of gratitude is a huge part of that. And as you do it, you know what might happen? You might start getting a sense of wonder. You might start recognizing, wow, God really does feed birds. He really does tailor the trees. This is His world. It's bathed in His luxurious kindness. All around me are things I didn't pay for and I cannot purchase or own. And they're all gifts from His hand. You start to see everything as gifts, then you clutch less tightly to your own. Yesterday, little Hill Griffin was at our house. The boys were playing basketball. He wanted to slam dunk, but he's like 8 inches tall. So that's a problem. He's not 8 inches tall. I don't know. He's 2 feet tall. He's 2 years old. So I pick him up. He takes the basketball, throws it down. He is delighted. You know what he says? Din. A din. I don't know. Again, he's saying again. It's a different language, but he's saying again. He wants to do it again. And I forgot. Oh, yeah. With little kids, like you do something that's strenuous and dangerous, and they want to do it over and over, and they will not tire of it. But it was awesome, because he thought it was awesome. G.K. Chesterton says, you know, I think God exults in monotony. We think maybe he just creates the daisies. I think he creates the daisies anew every single day because he just loves them. And if you think about this world that you inhabit, it's part of what Jesus is saying that antidotes our anxiety. You live in a world where God is active all the time, but mostly you're not noticing. You start to do that, you start to say to God, each morning, you start to be on the lookout for new mercies, no matter where they might be hiding, no matter where they might hop out from. They'll show up in frustrating things and in good things. So there's this giving of gratitude that's called on from us to be rich toward God and neighbor. And then there's just the giving of life and wallet. Paul says to the rich, tell them not to put their hope in riches which are so uncertain, but to be rich in good deeds. The scriptures don't tell everybody to divest everything. For some of you, that will be your calling. Give up everything. For a lot of you, your calling will be to be asking the question, what am I supposed to do with all this you've entrusted to me? Is this all for us? Or should it be for someone else? There's a story about a man who had a dream, and in his dream he went to hell. And while he was in hell, there was a large table. And on that table was an amazing spread of the choicest foods, decadent and rich and savory to smell and to taste. But the problem was everybody seated around the table had a really long spoon. And with the spoon, they could reach the food. But the spoon was so long that they couldn't get the food in their mouths. So they were cussing. And they were grumbling against each other. And they were complaining because there, just beyond their reach, was food they could not have. These long spoons that wouldn't fit in their mouths. Their arms weren't long enough. In his dream, he went to heaven. There was a similar table. And at that table was a similar spread, only instead of cussing and snorting and grumbling and complaining, you know what he heard? He heard laughter. He heard joy. He heard merriment and festivity. Because you know what was happening? Is that everybody had the same long spoon, but they realized they could feed their neighbor. And that they themselves could be fed by another. So everybody had all that they needed. And the joy was multiplied. That's part of what's so lovely about reading in the early church, that all the believers had everything in common. No one claimed any of their possessions as their own. It almost sounds like a world that doesn't exist. But when we have intimations of it here, it's so amazing to watch how we look out for each other, to look how we share with each other, to look how we invite each other's troubles on us. That's an antidote to all the kinds of trouble, the anxiety, the money sickness that comes into your life. And I've gone too long, and I'm going to close with this. Man, so much good stuff's being left out here. C.S. Lewis is someone I adore, an intellectual hero. And one of the things that I really resonate with him about is that he, it seems like me, had a lifelong struggle with money nervousness. I can remember as a small child, and as I grew up in adolescence, I didn't want to ask my parents for anything. I felt the anxiety of our family's financial situation. So when it came time, I just wanted to keep wearing my athletic shoes and not get a new pair each year, because I didn't want to ask for new ones until I absolutely, absolutely, absolutely had to have them. I felt like, I can't ask for anything. I don't want anybody to have to spend money on me. I don't want us to have to spend money. I was always worried about money. And I read C.S. Lewis one day, who said to a lady who was complaining about having to receive from someone else in her state of destitution, he says, I myself am a panicky person about money. Nothing scares me. I'm scared of poverty more than high cliffs and spiders. Poverty frightens me that much. But you know what I think he discovered is the same thing I've discovered. is that God means it when he says that he feeds the birds, that he beautifully decks out flowers. See, C.S. Lewis said, if God really wanted us not to be anxious, he would surely have given us an imagination like a flower. They don't worry because they can't imagine how bad it might get. But we can. But you know what's beyond imagining? What you have to kind of test out and see is that when you work through the anxiety, which is really anxieties for the godless, anxieties for people who are cosmic orphans in the world, who have no father looking out for them. When you work through the anxiety, you start to give, you start to be mindful of God and neighbor. I find myself less worried about money than I've ever been in my life. And we've been able to give away more money than I've ever thought we would ever give away. And I think, well, that doesn't make any sense. But neither does the life of faith. You have a God who feeds birds. A God who doesn't want you to be anxious, who doesn't want you to be afraid, and he doesn't want you to look to your possessions or to what money can get you to make you have a life. I, he says, am your life. I'm to be your treasure, and I've made you mine and given up my life that you might be it. I hope you can believe that. I hope you can believe that there's no need, none at all, to live thinking that your life consists in the abundance of possessions. Your life consists in him who feeds not only the birds, but each of you each day. Let's pray. Jesus, we're sorry it's so hard for us to trust. We're sorry it's so easy for us to get anxious and confused. We're sorry that we sometimes make all our decisions by ourselves, without you, without our neighbors, without taking either into account. Please change us from that. And hear us as we make our prayer of confession, which we'll find on the back of our bulletins, in preparation for coming to this table where you feed us.